Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
How if the kiss be denied?
Then she puts you into entreaty and there begins new matter.
What of my suit?
Not out of your apparel, yet out of your suit. Am not I your Rosalind?
I take some joy to say you are, because I would be talking of her.
Well then, in her person, I say I will not have you.
Then in mine own person, I die.
No, faith, die by attorney. This poor world is almost 6,000 years old, and in all that time, there was not any man died in his own person, videlicet in a love cause. Troilus had his brains dashed out with a Grecian club, although he did what he could to die before, and he is one of the very patterns of love. Leander would have lived for many a fair year, though Hero had turned none, had it not been for a hot midsummer night. For, good youth, he went but forth to wash him in the Hellespont, and there, being taken of a cramp, was drowned. And the foolish chronicles of that age did find it, Hero of Sestos. But these are all lies. Men have died from time to time, and worms have eaten them, but not for love.
I would not have my right, Rosalind, of this mind, for I protest her frown might kill me.
By this hand, it will not kill a fly.
Hello, and welcome to Act 4 of As You Like It, on The Play's the Thing. That was Rosalind and Orlando in Scene 2 of Act 4 of As You Like It. I'm Tim McIntosh, and I am joined by Heidi White. Heidi, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tim. So glad to be here.
It's nice to have you back, and we have arrived at Act 4. And
dun, dun, dun.
Heidi, we keep kind of chronicling along the way our adventures with coronavirus.
Yes.
And so I just think of it as sort of like a time capsule that maybe we can go back and when we listen to these episodes, people can say, oh, that was a year ago and everyone's okay now. But everyone was so worried and nobody knew what was going on. I just think that would be kind of enjoyable to have those sort of recordings. How's life with coronavirus for you? We are now in, isn't this the end of week 2 of the shutdown?
Oh gosh, I have no idea. It feels like week 77.
Doesn't it? And we basically got 3.5 to go, Heidi.
Presuming everything goes true.
The way that we want it to go, we still have 3.5 weeks.
Oh, it's true. But I definitely feel just right in the tunnel. And that sounds bad. Actually, we're having a great time. I hate the national crisis. I'm, you know, just like everybody in America, I'm worried about the economy. I'm being really careful about our health and we're washing our hands all the time and all that. But in terms of the time at home, man, we are, yesterday I planted, I think, 4 trays of flower and herb seeds.
Wow.
And I learned how to make sourdough bread. And I have cinnamon roll dough rising on the counter. And Lucy is watercoloring. And Jack is composing music. And I mean, we are like full on in the tunnel of, and I think tunnel's the wrong word, but I don't know any other word, just in this like sheltered kind of figuring out how to be at home together season, which is sometimes hard and sometimes really delightful. And also we have another 4 inches of snow, just covered with snow. So here we are. It's the end of days, but somehow I'm just making bread. How's it going in Seattle?
Well, I'm shut in. As people know, most people know that listen to this show, I built a little cottage with my friend Andrew on he and his wife's property. They have 4 kids. They're my godkids. And so I've been effectively really quarantined. I mean, I closed the door to my cottage and I really don't see anybody. The only people that I see are Andrew and Marianne and the kids. Like we went over, I think 2 nights ago, and we played spades and they ate hamburgers and fries and it was fun. And that's about as much socializing as I've had, gosh, in 5 days. Mm-hmm. So there's like, this is a little bit concerning. Andrew is going to get a test today because he's worried.
Okay.
Because he was like having trouble. That's overstating it. He wasn't having trouble breathing, but he was just like, he felt that it was like his lungs were being pressed. So he's going to get a test. So that worries me a little bit because if Andrew has it, I've had a lot of contact with Andrew as much as any contact with anybody. So we'll find out in a couple of days whether or not he's got it. I hope he doesn't have it for his sake.
That's
for his
scary.
Family's sake, for my sake. Yeah, I know. It is. In Seattle, I think the numbers have dropped this week.
Okay.
But it's still a hot spot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that it's is like concerning. There's a lot of it here.
It is concerning. And how does that impact you? We don't know yet anybody who has it, who's in the circle of people that we would have been connected to. So how does that feel to you?
Well, I don't know. I think I've got to, I mean, you know, if Andrew says he's got it, I think I've got to, we've got to figure out kind of like what our game plan is. If he's got it, you know, his wife has been heavily exposed.
Of course.
And I've been pretty exposed. So I think we just got to figure out, okay, what happens if, we just got to figure it out.
Right.
Yeah. I don't really know what that means.
Right.
You know, am I going grocery shopping for them and, you know, leaving the stuff at the front door?
Right.
Am I having no contact with them? I don't know.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It's tricky. And kind of existential, even though most, you know, most healthy people are not going to be in any danger from this virus. I'm sure with many exceptions to that, but it's still kind of an existential crisis. Because it's such big news.
Yeah.
And because it's a pandemic. So I think I would be afraid, even though I would be more afraid of having the coronavirus because of the big deal that it is in our culture than I would if I just got the cold or even the flu, which I've already had the flu and I wasn't worried at all. And I think that that's kind of an interesting, I've been thinking about that, just the psychological impact of the of the pandemic culture upon the psyche of individuals approaching this virus.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's nothing you could do about that. There is something just different feeling about it because of the cultural response to this pandemic. Even for people who are not terribly at risk of long-term, of death or long-term detrimental results and all of that. So I find that curious. Of course, it's perfectly natural.
So
anyway, I was wondering.
It struck me. We went for a walk around the neighborhood two nights ago before we were playing spades at the kitchen table. And the neighborhood, it was probably 5 o'clock that we went for a walk. The neighborhood was completely shut down. We saw two other couples that were out walking, you know, just like one was walking their dog, another couple guys, you know, were like throwing a baseball or something. Otherwise, completely shut down at 5 o'clock in a busy metropolitan neighborhood in like in a busy, busy city. And the Scrivener's kids went and knocked on a neighbor's door where they're, you know, they have friends at their neighbor's house. And it was remarkable how you can just tell it's the thing that everyone thinks about when they open the door, and everyone is kind of like positioning themselves. Okay, am I 6 feet away? Oh, I'd love to come out and play. I can't come out and play, you know? And I've thought about, I've not been in a situation like this where a city, or in this case, our whole country and kind of the whole world is centrally preoccupied with one thing so that it's organizing everybody's behavior. I mean, it's remarkable. It's like a testament to how, like, it is a global, we don't live in neighborhoods anymore. We live in this kind of big global universe that we can all be understanding this kind of common threat in a very common way. And my suspicion is, even at the height of the bubonic plague, there wasn't that much of a unified kind of approach to what was going on, because presumably we just didn't understand it the way that we understand this virus. Even though we don't, like, right, we don't know how to solve it. That's really struck me. I've been thinking about that a lot.
Right.
That just, and even what, 15, 20 years ago, I don't think the response would be as unified, because we didn't have the internet. We had television news, but there wasn't, right, kind of like this massive trove of information that people could access,
right,
sometimes for harm, but oftentimes for good. It's just a really different world.
It is. It is different. And it's interesting how it's both gathering, people and isolating at the same time.
Yeah.
Just this phenomenon is, I mean, I'm watching it just spellbound. And really, really sad for the impact that it's have, you know, my mom has terminal cancer, and she's in chemo right now. And, you know, if she catches this virus, it's very unlikely she'll live through it. So it isn't depersonalized for me. This is real, mm-hmm, for all of us. You know, mm-hmm, we all know somebody like that who's deeply at risk. And so just the human cost and the human impact, there's something very redemptive about the quarantine, potentially redemptive about kind of the gathering together of in homes. The, you know, I just keep thinking of that Pascal quote that, you know, most of our problems come from not being able to sit in a room alone for 15 minutes.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And that's really what we're being asked to do, is be at, yeah, home and be alone and quiet. Like, look,
right,
at yourself, like examine yourself. And live life a little differently, a little less frantically. And there's a lot of potential redemption in that, but there's also a lot of anxiety inherent in that too, as well as there being an actual real threat to human life, mm-hmm, that, mm-hmm, is ravaging society. So those two things are equally there, the potential redemptive kind of self-reflective, the potential for prayer, and for connection in a new way, that's real. And then the threat is also real.
Heidi, can I ask how your dad is approaching your mom? Like, you know, they live in the same house. How are,
right,
they tackling that? Have you talked to him about that?
Yeah, I just talked to him the other day. And my dad's got to be really careful when he goes to the grocery store, and they live alone, and that's it's hard. They're both anxious, but not living in fear. My parents are mature people. My dad is a very mature man, but he, you know, he's bearing the burden of the household and knowing that if my mom is exposed to it, it's through him.
Yeah.
You know, somehow, because he has to go out and go to the grocery store and run errands and get gas, right, and all the things that people still have to do. So that weighs on him for sure. And he's
fearful.
Yeah. So anyway, and I know that that's true, you know, pray for my family as we're praying for everybody. It gets, this is universal. And as you said, it's pretty rare that a global community faces the same threat at the same time. Like that doesn't happen very often. So it is unique. This is unique in this generation. So anyway, thanks for asking and I'll be praying for you.
Thanks.
You should look into grocery delivery. Do you have that in Seattle?
I'm sure that we do. The question is whether or not it's too overloaded, but I would, I'll look into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Heidi, let's turn our attention to Act 4 of As You Like It. We're kind of, we've rounded the bend and we've hit this act that we've talked about. Act 4 is often, for Shakespeare, it's a strange sort of no man's land. Like I always think of Act 4 of Hamlet is oftentimes rarely performed. It's the one where Hamlet goes on the ship to return to England and it's usually just cut. And if there's something cut in these long plays from Shakespeare, it usually is cut from Act 4. So we go from a 3-hour performance down to a more reasonable 2-hour performance. However, I don't think that's the case for As You Like It. I don't think that Act 4 is pretty crucial in this play.
Yes.
And it occurred to me as I was reading it, Heidi, that As You Like It, there are a couple of different themes that have shown up in this play. Boy, but the theme of marriage seems to me really coming to the fore. In the audio that we played, we're listening to Rosalind kind of give a little bit of I don't know what you would call it, an anthology of these people who have these famous heroes from history and how they kind of either were afflicted by love or afflicted love itself. And it occurred to me, a lot of this play is about these different characters having different visions of what love and marriage are about. And it seems to me that Rosalind and Orlando's vision is kind of the fullest. It's the most, it's like the view of marriage that I would want to follow. And I think part of the reason why they have such a full view is because they're not planning to remain in Arden for the rest of their lives. It's clear that they have intentions of returning, like they have responsibilities back in the real world. And I wonder if some of these other characters, they're so content being in Arden. They're so content kind of being in this oasis away from the corrupting influence of the city and of the Duke that they maybe have a little bit of a more adolescent view of marriage. Some of them do. And so here's what I see. Touchstone kind of sees marriage as like a means of, I don't know, like putting his desire. His girlfriend, fiance, sees marriage as a way of moving up in the world. She's going to kind of like stair step up in society because she marries well. Sylvius and Phoebe, their view of marriage is sort of like maybe like a slight dull to the pain. Like everything is just frustrating for them. And I think Sylvius seems like he's just a boy who wants to be married. And Phoebe seems like a girl who wants to be in love, and she's kind of like willing to attach to whoever she finds at the moment. She happens to find that it's Rosalind disguised as a boy for a while, and so she casts her affection for him. So I see all these different characters seeking these different views, or espousing these different views of love and the goods that it brings them. Am I right in saying that Orlando and Rosalind's view is the most mature? And the second part of my question is it actually healthy, or is it just the most mature among immature visions?
Oh, I think that's a really good question. And there's probably different takes on that. I think it's more, in the first half of the play, it's more the latter, that theirs is kind of the least ridiculous among more ridiculous options, right? Last time we talked about Sylvius mm-hmm. and Phoebe being a parody of the courtly love tradition, Touchstone and Audrey being a parody of the pastoral love tradition. And then there's all of these disordered loves within the society, the primogenitor problem, the green world versus the corrupt society, that kind of thing. And so Shakespeare is poking fun and then also satirizing various types of disordered loves. And Rosalind and Orlando have kind of the best option for the first half of the play. They seem genuinely attracted to each other. They're especially Rosalind is just purely delightful. And Orlando seems like a pretty good option. I mean, we talked about how he's not quite worthy of her in the first half of the play.
Yeah.
But act four, as Shakespeare is wont to do, I see him starting to tie these threads together to actually form something really lovely. And I think Rosalind and Orlando in this act form a true bond, like a real love.
Yeah.
And the other couples kind of get paired off and start to, instead of being mad at each other or pushed away from each other, they're kind of starting to come together, but their love isn't, at least at this point, and maybe ever, it isn't less ridiculous. It's still kind of silly. Like Sylvius and Phoebe, you can tell they don't have a snowball's chance, right? Like to really right. actually be happy, but they're starting to come together. And largely due to Rosalind, because she wants to pair people up. She wants people to find love and be happy. And so she kind of puts this harmonizing influence on all these different ridiculous loves. But what I like about Rosalind and Orlando, I'm not sure which direction you want to take the conversation, so I'm going to just throw some things out there, is that she is not the one who redeems him. She has an influence on him, and she tells him how to love and how to woo a lady. And it's really funny and really sweet and delightful, those scenes. But it is Orlando himself who chooses to rise up to what it means to love somebody through his relationship with his brother. And so it's really interesting how Shakespeare brings all these things together and starts to harmonize the disorder in the play.
And a lot of that harmonizing takes place through Rosalind, doesn't it?
That's how I see it. Yes. I mean, we talked last time about Rosalind as this boundary crossing character. Mm-hmm. She's willing to change her identity. We see from the beginning, Rosalind is willing to change. She's willing to take drastic measures in order to pursue the good.
Yeah. You know,
she leaves the corrupt society and goes into the green world. She abandons her identity as a woman who can be found and discovered and brought back into subjection by dressing up as Ganymede. She is willing to sublimate her identity as a woman in order to educate Orlando on how to love in the guise of Ganymede. So we see that she crosses these rigid social boundaries and her own existential identity for the sake of love. And that begins to bring people together. That begins to do its good work on the souls of those around her. For example, Sylvius and Phoebe in Act 4, they are, Phoebe falls in love with Ganymede, which is, you know, funny, and the audience is laughing their heads off. And
yeah,
it's a great addition to the play, just on the plot level. But underneath, what happens then is that Rosalind teases them, kind of pokes at that, the problems in their relate, the disorder in their love, which is this parody of the courtly love tradition, in which the man is dying for love of a worthy lady, and he tries to make himself worthy of her, and she spurns him and is cold to him until he shows himself worthy. That's the courtly love tradition. That's what's being mocked here, because in every way Phoebe's unworthy of Sylvius's love.
Right.
And but Rosalind changes that, right? Mm. She kind of shames Phoebe into being able to see herself, mm-hmm. and then turn towards the man who loves her, and she teases Sylvius so that he will act like a man,
mm-hmm.
and not a worm and not a doormat.
Yeah.
And then because of that, she exudes this, you know, this invitation to love rightly, and then brings them together. And it is her work that does that. So that's just an example of the influence. What else do you see in Rosalind?
Before we leave it, I want to say, because we're reading on Close Reads, we're reading Anne of Green Gables.
Hmm.
I see Rosalind. Rosalind reminds me of Anne.
Hmm.
She's very different. She's very, very different. She doesn't have to go through that sort of maturation process that provides so much of the joy of Anne of Green Gables. You know, Anne makes these terrible mistakes and is so repentant for them and kind of has to learn from her mistakes. I don't see Rosalind having to make those same sort of mistakes, but both of them have this sort of light felicity.
What a great phrase.
And it's disarming. You kind of can't help but be, if you're a character in the play, but you have to kind of put down your weapons when Rosalind starts speaking, when Anne starts speaking. And I don't know, I see that kind of similarity between the two of them and their effects upon other characters, I think, is kind of similar. I don't want to make too much out of it because they're very different, but
no, that's good.
The kind of playfulness that both of them have just struck me as really, it's my favorite aspect of both of their characters. I love
it. That's good. I really like that. They both have kind of this merry wisdom to them, right?
Yeah.
And they want what's good for others and are at the expense of themselves. But what I like about Rosalind and Anne is that the play isn't too serious. The play is lighthearted. The book, Anne of Green Gables, is lighthearted. And so even though they encounter real human troubles, the tone of it kind of lends itself so that these characters can just kind of resolve things through their delightful, merry influence on others. And and it's not this like long journey of the soul. It just is like, oh, now I'm in love. And it's sweet. And it works because these characters, you're exactly right. Like both Rosalind and Anne, even in the midst of their lighthearted circumstances, they have a depth of soul to them that influences those around them. But the tone is still lighthearted enough that it's not, you know, this, like I said, kind of this like odyssey of human discovery. It's just fun.
We have enough of that in Crime and Punishment and in COVID.
That's right. We need both. But it's nice to have something lighthearted.
I think that Rosalind is much more aware of her wisdom. I don't mean in an egotistical way, but I think she kind of has a sense that she has it. Whereas I think Anne has no idea. She has no idea that she has this kind of effect on other people. She knows that she, you know, has a rich imagination and that's what her life is supposed to be about. That's what she wants to pursue. But I don't know the kind of natural wisdom. I don't think that Anne knows that she has that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Hey, we see a big change in one of the antagonists of the play in this act.
Huh.
We see Oliver again. We meet Oliver in the woods. Can you tell us what happens with Oliver? So just to set it up, Oliver, brother of Orlando, at the top of the play, Oliver essentially throws Orlando out. He is withholding their father's wealth from Orlando, even though it was due to him in some regard. And so Orlando is not able to achieve gentlemanly status. He's not able to achieve an education. And after Orlando has this fight with the wrestler, he ends up having no choice but to flee into the woods. He's already met Rosalind, so he's already fallen in love with Rosalind, at least a little bit. And he meets Rosalind again in Act 3. But we kind of lose track in the play of Oliver until we meet him in Act 4. Tell us what happens, Heidi, with Oliver.
Well, Orlando has a choice to make. Oliver is under threat from a lion, and Orlando has the opportunity to choose whether or not he will save him or let his brother be killed by this wild beast, which, you know, many commentators see the wild beast as kind of this aspect of the broken manhood in Oliver. Like he has destroyed himself. Like the wild beast is his own animal nature, his own greed, and Orlando has the opportunity to let Oliver then die or to save him. And he chooses to save him. And this is, I think, the moment in the play that we can look and say, oh, Orlando really becomes a man at this point. He becomes worthy of this woman who is in every way at this point higher than him, better than him in character. And he's not a bad man, as we talked about. He's just an ordinary young man, but unworthy of this wonderful woman. And here he lays down his anger, his pride, his resentments, and saves his brother in a very Christ-like manner. And it's this, I really love the fact that Orlando did this without Rosalind. She doesn't make him do it.
Yeah.
He does it himself.
He's not showing off for her.
Yes. And it is his own existential crisis here, his own opportunity to to give into his animal nature, right? To the law of the forest, and to let this brother who has so wronged him in every way and is actually coming to the forest to murder him. That's why Oliver's coming.
Yeah.
And so this is very melodramatic, but again, within the context of the play, it kind of just feels like another part of this lighthearted comedy. And so I don't want to make too much of, you know, this is where the play gets dark. It really doesn't get dark. It really stays the same tone, but Orlando makes the right choice here. And then becomes worthy of his lady love.
Hey, Heidi, I want to point something out about the line, just a little bit of stagecraft from Shakespeare. There were in London at the time, bear baiting was a big spectator event. You know, we think of bear baiting now as sort of like cockfighting and dog right. fighting. It's just like, you know, it's a forbidden thing, but apparently it was,
yeah. And it was even at the time, but they did it anyway.
So some people think that, in The Winter's Tale. So I'm taking this from the reference to the lion. When I was reading this, I thought, oh my, there's no way that he like put a live animal on the stage is there. And then I saw like, oh, okay, good. There's no action scene. So I don't have to like think about whether or not Shakespeare actually tried that. But some commentators think that in The Winter's Tale, there's this famous stage direction. It's the most famous stage direction in Shakespeare, exit pursued by a bear. And some people think that Shakespeare might've put the bear on stage for a little bit, which is, I know, because their thinking is some bears were train back in the day. And if anybody was going to try it, it would have been Shakespeare. I find that like implausible, but it's still kind of, I mean, I'm just thinking about a bear, even a trained bear on a, pardon the pun, bear stage in front of spectators. I just think the risk is so great that even the spectacle of it couldn't overwhelm the kind of insurance risk that would pose.
Oh man, so, I hope anyway, it's true though. That's
oh, I would love cool. it to be true. It'd just be so, it'd be so fun. Another aspect of the mystique. But anyway, I just thought about this lion scene when I thought that like maybe we were going to see something spectacular on stage that made me think of that. Did you see like a little glimpse of something between Oliver and Celia?
Yeah. I mean,
like it kind of has to happen, doesn't it, Heidi? I mean, Celia has been unpaired this whole time.
Right. And I love that about Shakespeare, is he always gives people second chances, right? So an opportunity to repent and to change. And that I think especially in the comedies, he's just really kind to his characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not all of them. There's plenty of exceptions to that. But in this particular instance, you do see a little spark. And you've been wondering about Celia, right? She's pretty. She's merry. She's sweet. You know, right. Who's she going to end up with?
Right.
Because especially particularly with women, it seems Shakespeare pretty much marries off all of his young women. A lot of the time there's a leftover guy.
Yeah.
You know, and we talked about that, you and I, before on the show, kind of a lonely outsider to the marriage who kind of reminds us that life is still tragic and a veil of tears, but there's some, but generally with the young women, they get married off. And so here we see, Oliver and Celia, wouldn't that be great if Oliver was a good guy? Because then they could all share the wealth and be together and be a little community, and that'd be darling. Yeah. So,
well, yeah. I've got my fingers crossed, which brings us to our segue out of the show. What I'm going to be looking for in Act 5 is really simple. I'm going to look for whether or not Oliver and Celia end up together. I'm going to be looking for other things, but that's one of the main things that I'm going to be looking for. What are you going to be looking for, Heidi?
Well, you know, I'm just always interested in these outsider characters. So I just always have my eye on Jacques.
Yeah. What's going to happen with Jacques? His vision of marriage is that it's just kind of, and maybe love, is it's just sort of an absurd pastime, maybe. Like he holds it in the same sort of regard he does his fellow man. It's, we're absurd pastimes.
Yes.
And is that going to stick through the end of the play, or is there some off chance that he meets someone? What's your bet, Heidi? What's your bet about what happens with Jacques?
I bet he stays the same. He seems pretty static, but
yeah.
I'm curious if there's any kind of, I think with, you know, and we spent quite a lot of time talking about Jacques, and Rosalind roundly puts him in his place in scene one of act four. And it's an interesting conversation. She rebukes him for his melancholy, and he responds, and he just always has this kind of whiny tone instead of this tragic dignity that some of the other outsider characters have in the comedies. He just kind of seems whiny and ridiculous the whole time. So I'm watching that, if there's any kind of dignity that's bestowed upon him or whether he remains the same.
Great. That's a great thing to look for. So our next recording will be the closing episode, Act 5 of As You Like It. Remember that you guys can join the conversation, listeners, online through Facebook, through the Close Reads discussion group, which, Heidi, continues to grow and kind of like have momentum. Is this place that people like ask everything about books to recipes to child rearing ideas. I love to check in on it and just see what new conversation has bubbled up. And I love it because it seems like it's this place where the conversation is so dignified and everyone is kind of like learned that to kind of trust the kind of co-conversationalist on this Facebook page, I just find it delightful.
Yeah.
It's got to be the most respectful space in the entire, you know, interworld.
Yes. It is just wonderful. Like that I love the conversations. And I learn so much. Like I gain so much insight, which is why, I mean, we do what we do, right, Tim? Like
yeah.
that we love reading in community. And it's not just a community between the contributors on the podcast. It's a community with these other incredibly insightful people who see things I don't see and
Absolutely.
I learn from and
yeah.
remind us of details from the books and add their own thoughts and, you know, argue with us at times, which just creates a conversation. I love it. It's wonderful. So any listeners, please, we want to hear from you. And since we're releasing this particular play on this podcast, on the Plays the Thing podcast in a batch, I'm hoping that readers will, and listeners, excuse me, will still contribute their thoughts to you and I and just tag us and tell us it's about the Plays the Thing, I guess. Would that work?
Yeah. We've got to figure out whether or not we can accumulate enough questions because people will not have been listening along with us. Mm-hmm. So we'll have a plan for that and we'll tell everybody about that in the next episode. Heidi, you and I need to talk about that off the air.
Right.
So meanwhile, you can follow the Close Reads discussion group, or in this case, the Plays the Thing discussion group is kind of patched into that on Instagram and on Twitter at Close Reads Pods. And you can also get our email by writing closereadspodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget our email newsletter, which you can sign up for at closereads.substack.com. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Next week, Act 5 of As You Like It. For Heidi White, I am Tim McIntosh for the Plays the Thing. Thank you, and happy listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.